Tom Miller developed a reputation for writing about life in the American Southwest and Latin America. He started out as a journalist covering the anti-war movement for the underground press back in the 1960s. Tom had collected his memoirs in a book called Where Was I? And he wanted to talk with us about his career on Travel with Rick Steves as his Parkinson's diagnosis was progressing rapidly. It would take him a few months later. Let's listen right now to our conversation with Tom as a way to honor his work and his life as a writer and observer of our world. So, Tom, you've spent a lifetime writing about your travels and observing the world. When you review 50 years of travel writing, is there any sweeping conclusion you can draw from all the work you've done and the travels you've done and how the world has changed?
Yes. How the world has changed is emphatic. How you change has a lot to do with where you go, who you look for, who looks for you. The individuals who you meet along the way are your teachers.
Now, I'm sorry to hear that you've been diagnosed with Parkinson's at age 62, and that must be a difficult adjustment for a person so accustomed to an active lifestyle and for a writer. How is it to be dealing with freedom in your writing, and now your freedom is being taken away from you by the challenge of Parkinson's?
Well, that's quite true. Parkinson's takes the travel out of travel writing. That's one of the reasons I was doing this memoir. I was at the time, I was doing some travel in Spain and I was doing some travel in Cuba. And both of them, my body just refused to let me go on any further. So I came back home and I started to look, what have I done over the years? Instead of looking at individual pieces, I looked at them all and made them go together. There's a certain continuity in these articles and these essays and in this travel writing. There's a certain continuity that I'm able to pull together.
You know, that's an interesting observation, whether people have health struggles or not. It's just you can get value out of your memories by reliving them and reviewing them and learning from them again. All of us travelers have been unable to travel like we like during a couple of years of the pandemic. And I found I was looking back at my journals and enjoying things that I had forgotten to enjoy.
The enjoyment comes from the looking at it from the far end. The enjoyment isn't so much at the near end where you're doing things individually. To me, travel writing is what goes on. You observe what goes on when nobody's looking. That's probably the best way to put it. What's going on when nobody's looking, that's travel writing.
I love that. What's going on when nobody's looking. And that's been a theme in your writing. When you look back on decades of travel writing, is there a particular trip that you're most thankful that you took when you had a chance?
Well, in general, traveling along the U.S.-Mexico border, I look at that as a third country, 2,000 miles long, 20 miles wide. It's a third country between the United States and Mexico. This third country is one that I've been traveling off and on since the late 1960s. That, to me, was a trip that I never stopped taking.
And that must have inspired you to look at things differently when you thought about the differences between countries, that they can be so striking that even the places where they come together can be a cultural zone in themselves.
Absolutely. I found that traveling in Cuba, for example, there's very different personality from the southeast end of Cuba to the northwest end. And I found that traveling both of those by taking notes, by going over them once I'm back home, I see something that I wasn't aware of at the time that it took place.
You know, you've got a knack for observing, and I've always been inspired by that. People who are accomplished travel writers, they have a keen ability to observe. And you actually did a story about the Panama hat, tracking it from 40 cents worth of raw straw to a $35 item on a store in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Certainly. A Panama hat, first of all, let's get the name straight. Where do Panama hats come from? Rick, where would you say they come from?
I would guess they come from Panama.
You would guess, but you'd be wrong.
I bet I would be. Where do they come from?
They come from Ecuador. The raw straw that the hats are made out of come from the lowlands and the coastal area of Ecuador. I went out with the straw cutters. They get the straw, the raw straw. They bring it back to their village. They wash the straw, they clean it, really the hats go through an enormous process in Ecuador, and the price of the hat keeps going up, the price of the labor keeps going up. The people who went out with this raw straw make maybe $1 a day, maybe $2 a day, but then the payment that they receive keeps going up slightly and slightly, a little more and a little more.
Mm-hmm.
To the very end, we're at a hat shop in downtown San Diego. Somebody bought a hat for $40. There's any number of places and people that get involved in this whole process. But when you start out with raw straw in the lowlands of Ecuador and you end up in a fancy hat shop in San Diego, it gives you an idea of the economy of the country, of the world, really.
You know, it reminds me of the value chain that from a coffee bean of some indigenous farmer in Guatemala to the fancy coffee shop in the United States. Also, a couple of pennies worth of coffee ends up to be $5 for a cup in San Diego. And you think about the supply chain and the value chain, and we're talking about the supply chain right now as American consumers are frustrated by things. But when we travel, we can piece that together, and it kind of injects a little bit of humanity in the whole process of getting that little bit of straw in South America to the consumer in the United States and a nice Panama hat.
One of the questions you asked earlier about what my favorite trips were, I wouldn't say any trip is my favorite because they're all my favorites. However, that one probably tells a story more than any other story. It gives the economy, it gives art, it gives geography. There's no way you can tell a story as deep as the Panama hat.
We're remembering writer Tom Miller in an interview we recorded with him for Travel with Rick Steves a few months before he passed away in December last year. Tom had just written Where Was I?, a travel writer's memoir. His titles on Cuba include Trading with the Enemy, and offbeat essays about the American Southwest are in his book Revenge of the Saguaro. His papers are collected at the University of Arizona Special Collections. Tom, I'm curious, as we have a lot of travelers listening, and you've made a career out of travel writing, how do you make a living as a freelance travel writer? Do people still make a living today the way they did when you started?
I'm still convinced that you can find a good story at any moment in any country, talking with any group of people.
I know you can do that, but how do you pay your bills with that? How do you make some money off of that?
Boy, I wish I knew.
Yeah, because in the old days, people would send a proposal to a magazine and they'd send you out on a mission and you'd bring home the story and you'd earn a living. You wouldn't maybe earn a huge living, but you'd live off of it. Do people still do that, or is it just clickbait on the internet?
No, I think you're right. The internet has really sabotaged the form of travel writing that I grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you can still get to places. You can talk to editors before you start out. I know people who are trying to make a living at it, and they'll do fairly well. Nobody gets rich. It's travel writing is not a get rich quick scheme.
Well, you were pretty creative in cobbling your livelihood together. I was reading about how you actually, I guess you were writing the travel content for Land's End catalog. You mentioned it was 98% sales and 2% you.
Yes, that's true. The Land's End catalog asked me to do a bunch of stories that didn't really deal with the products that Land's End brought out. These are stories that were assigned rather than stories that I was looking for. But there was a pretty wide range of stories that I looked for and that looked for me.
I suppose people would look for you when you had a reputation and you had to be pretty creative to see what was out there. Unpredictable. Somebody wanted to hire you to write a script for a 60-minute doc on baseball in Cuba.
Yes, that would have been, unfortunately, my co-writer on that up and died in the middle of the process. So we never did get it written. However, the idea of using Cuban baseball as a device for writing the history of Cuban politics still has a great appeal to me.
Oh, yeah. You know, one thing I've found, it's really all about people. Can we wrap up this interview with just a personal encounter you had with a person or some people and how you were able to share it in a way where people would go, wow, Tom Miller created a sense of place, and it was all about meeting that person.
Well, I'll tell you, the most exciting to write about was a man I never met. He was a drunken fool who was out in the desert north of Phoenix, Arizona. He just wanted to go shoot cactus. That's what it was. There's nothing worse than shooting cactus, I always thought. And he got a few of them. He shot some of them. They fell down. There's one cactus that just wouldn't fall down. He tried, he may, he couldn't get it to fall down. So he walked up to it, picked the saguaro rib off the ground, poked at the arm of the cactus. The cactus fell on him and killed him. Simple as that. The 500-pound arm of a cactus fell on him and killed him.
Whoa.
That was not my favorite man, but that was my favorite story. Now, what happened after that was the cactus itself was wobbling around and lost its ballast, and it too fell on him. I think of that as a double homicide.
The revenge of the saguaro.
Revenge of the saguaro. There's another thing for everybody to learn. It has a W sound, not a G. Saguaro.
Saguaro. All right. Well, Tom Miller, it's been good to talk to you, and I wish you all the best. And thanks for sharing your travels in your new book, which is a memoir, Where Was I? A Travel Writer's Memoir.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
We have links to the work of Tom Miller with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. On a completely different note now, it's said that there are as many as 1,500 different varieties of sausages that you can eat in Germany. Many towns have their own local specialties. Tour guides Iris André and Matthias Unger from Berlin join us now on Travel with Rick Steves to help us appreciate a good German sausage any time of year and any time of day. Iris, Matti, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Matti, I just explained sausages in kind of sweeping terms. What is it about sausages and German people?
I think we eat sausage for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, any time, every time of the day, all year long.
But what is it about sausages? Is it part of your heritage? Is it just tasty? Is it easy to preserve? Or why do you have so many sausages? Iris, do you know?
I think it's, first of all, because of our climate. Most of the northern parts of Germany, we have a pretty cold climate. We have a lot of pigs. And it was a way of also preserving food during the time when there was not refrigeration around. Sausages, you could smoke them and hang them up in your barn, and they would keep over the winter
and
the summer.
Before there was refrigeration. Most sausages are based on pork.
Yeah, and some people, they are hung up about expiration dates nowadays. But hey, they're sausages, they're smoked, you can keep them almost forever. They used to go on boats for a long time. So the tradition has stayed, and yeah, we have hard time living without them.
Now there's a concept called Brotzeit. What is that?
Traditional German people do not have really dinner in the American sense. We have very heavy lunches, and in the evening at around 6, 6:30, we would sit down and eat almost the same as we have for breakfast. Which is bread with a little bit of butter or margarine, and then you have your different kind of cold cuts, cheeses. Maybe you have some pickles with it or some cucumbers and peppers, like crudité that you cut up.
And sausages.
And you even have the sausages with it.
Matti, Brotzeit, is that literally time for bread? Brotzeit?
Bread time. Bread time.
So bread is a big deal in Germany. I love a German bakery. When you're thinking of the importance of sausage, it goes with bread. Talk about good bread in Germany. What do you enjoy with your sausage?
If you think about Germany, you think about dark bread, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rye bread, really dark bread.
And this dark bread really is dark. I mean, it's like black bread almost. When you're thinking about this Brotzeit, time for bread, it's going to have sausages. This would change from region to region. Let's talk just a bit about cities and regions that have a famous sausage. Iris, when you think about sausages, what cities or regions come to mind?
The first one that comes to my mind, which I personally do not like so much, is the ones from Munich, the Weißwürstel, which are white sausages.
I've seen the white sausages with the sauerkraut or the pretzel in the beer halls. And these would be typically Bavarian?
Yes.
So they're Weißwurst, literally white sausages.
Exactly. And you have to eat them in a certain way where you cannot eat the peel.
Oh, you can't.
And it's a little bit of etiquette, you know, how you get the peel off. And uh-huh. some locals, they just, they almost suck the sausage out of the peel.
So you're left with the shell there, the, just the skin, and you throw that away.
Yes.
This is good for our travelers to know. So with a white sausage in Munich, don't suffer through
no.
the skin.
You don't
it's
eat
a tube.
The peel.
It's a tube. It's like eating toothpaste.
Exactly. No.
I was just checking you. No. But it's a tube. You eat what's inside of the skin.
Yes.
All right. Mati, I know when I go to Nuremberg, there's these lovely little sausages.
They're called Nürnberger, and they're really, like, really finger tiny.
Like the little finger.
Yes, yeah. yes. You put them in a roll, like yeah. five pieces, and they're a little spicy. You have to have sweet mustard with it.
Okay,
sweet
now that's
mustard,
that's
yes.
a sausage skill, because in Germany, the mustard, the Senf, is very important, and you have different kinds of Senf. In a grocery store, what would you see for the different kinds of mustard?
You have extra hot.
Extra hot?
Extra hot. You have middle hot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, medium hot.
And
you have the sweet one.
Okay, so then in German, the three words, or the words would be, sweet would be what?
Süß.
And a little bit hot would be?
Medium.
Medium. And in German, what
or
is
mittel.
That? Mittel.
Mittel.
And then
medium.
The hot would be called?
Mittel.
Scharf.
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 So there's scharf, there's
yes.
middle scharf, and there's süß for sweet. Very important to know.
Yes.
But getting back to Nuremberg, we have the Nuremberg sausage, three or four or five little sausages the size of your little finger
yes.
on a roll.
Whenever you come to a Christmas market there,
I love
my
that.
God, go. They're freshly done on the barbecue, into a roll.
It's a tradition, and especially in Nuremberg. It's one reason I go to Nuremberg. And both of you are from Berlin. In Berlin, we have the currywurst.
Oh, yes.
Iris, tell us why the Berliners love their currywurst.
First of all, the Berliners believe that the currywurst is theirs. They invented it across the Republic in a town called Bochum. The people believe they invented it, so it's like a little war across the Republic who did it really. Mm. I believe that the Berliners might be right with that because of our history with the Second World War. When the British came, there was a liking for the curry.
Okay, so that's the English have their Indian cuisine and so on, so they
exactly.
spice the sausage.
So that they brought the idea of the curry to the people in Berlin, and that some clever woman thought, well, let's put it on sausages with ketchup.
So, Matti, describe a currywurst for our listeners.
So you go to this woman who sells a currywurst, and she will ask you, with or without the skin.
Mm-hmm.
Then she is going to ask you 50 questions about how spicy, how much ketchup, which kind of, with mayonnaise or not.
So, but let me get this straight. You have maybe a paper plate because it's a fast food place in German style. You're going to take it out. You're going to take it to go. It's very cheap and quick, and all the local workers are there. You ask for it without the skin. So you're going to get this sausage pulled out of its skin.
In pieces.
In pieces.
Yes.
And then different sauces to put on?
Different sauces. You have to tell her what kind of sauce.
You can have hot and spicy.
Hot, spicy. On mayonnaise or mayonnaise and ketchup is called red and white.
Red and white.
Rot und weiß.
Ah, so if you want to sound like a local and they say, what would you like on it?
Rot weiß.
Red and white. Matti and Iris, thank you so much for giving us a better understanding of the sausage culture.
Okay, you're welcome.
In Deutschland.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Danke.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Quirt. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Thanks to our colleagues at Arizona Public Media for their help. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.